Hello, everyone. Welcome to Satsang. And just before we begin, a reminder to please put your phones on silent. So that ceremony that we just participated in is honoring the guru who has the power to transmit Shaktipat, the awakening of the Kundalini energy, which makes meditation so much easier. After Shaktipat, I would just walk into the meditation hall, sit down, and for an hour, I was like that, in some kind of deep state. And when I came out of it, it was like, for about an hour, it was like a waking meditation. And such is the power of the guru to give us an opportunity to go deep within. So all that was to honor that Shakti, that power. And when we come to Satsang, it's a place where we can learn to see the divine everywhere, outside and inside. And also it's a place, it's a time when we can have an experience of the divine energy, if we're alert to it, if we turn within and contemplate the teachings that we'll be hearing tonight. And tonight, Swamiji will be sharing some teachings from what he calls Ganesh Puri Days, which is questions and answers with Baba from his time in India, in Sri Gurudev Ashram in this early 70s. And because I was emceeing tonight, I went to him and I said, you know, I'd like to do something from your book, your memoir, which will be published hopefully by June next year or July. Correct? Yes, correct, Mr. Shivaraj? Yes. And I wanted to set the mood. Does that sound right? The atmosphere of what it was like, and during those years. So I've got a little. Should I show it now? I don't know when to show the photograph of the courtyard. All right. I'm not very good with media stuff, so Swamiji would never let me use a blackboard or a whiteboard because I was so bad at it. All right. Is it there? So this is a very typical scene. And the scene was like this when I got there in 1978. So I don't know, this could be a question and answer session. Is that? It is, okay. I didn't know, but it looked like one. And if you see the woman sitting in front of the post, that's Girija, who Swamiji ventured to India with, his wife, his then wife. And so this was the mood, and it was the ashram was so beautiful, so incredibly beautiful and full of Shakti. And so this ashram is mimicking that ashram, you could say, but it has its own, because we're Westerners, it has a different feeling, but the same feeling all at the same time. So I've got this bit from his book called Questions and Answers. And this will set the mood for what's to come.
Let me just say that, as many of you know, in the early days of the Q&A, it was in this room. But after a while, the numbers grew, couldn't fit in his room anymore, so we came out here into the courtyard. So that's a little later.
Yeah. So Baba's sitting up there on what they called his perch, and the door to his room, his apartment, is through that little window. It's actually a little door that he used to crawl in and out of. All right, so questions and answers. Am I taking too long? We need some cool air, I think, don't we? Humid in here? Too humid. Thanks. So, before a lot of chapters, Swamiji has an epigraph, so I thought I would read that, begin with that. It's chapter 26. I pay homage to the wonderful words of my guru, full of profound meaning, which are a boat to take me across the fathomless ocean of doubt and show me my true nature. It's from the Spandakarikas. Swamiji writes, if sadhana was our main business in the ashram, one of the background themes was the relationship of the Westerners with our Indian hosts. The Indians were wonderful, welcoming, intensely spiritual, and warm-hearted. But sometimes the cultural gap yawned between us. For a while, I worked closely with Desai, who is one of the ashram managers. He stood at the cutting edge of the Indian-Western interface. He had to put foreign visitors into the proper dormitories, tell them the rules and the schedule. Once he turned to me after a frustrating encounter with a new Western ashramite and said, the foreigners always ask, why? They should not ask why? They should just do. Of course, Westerners do nothing without lengthy explanations. And even then, they feel an entitlement to argue and revise. I was no different. The hardy bunch of my fellow ashramites and I were thrown into the grinding world of the ashram without any explanation whatsoever. We just did. Morning till night, we followed the routine without asking too many questions. The problem was that our hungry Western minds needed something more than the relentless turning of the wheel of duty. Or at least we thought we did. Eventually, I understood that Baba's methodology was osmosis, pure and simple. He believed that if a person lived with him for a while, knowledge would automatically flow into them as water flows down a hill. He had great faith in this process of transmission and would tell people, just live here for a while. This is the time-honored method of Eastern discipleship. There are dozens of stories about illiterate disciples who cook and clean for their guru and suddenly are able to spontaneously write divine poetry. Or in the Zen tradition of students who want to learn swordsmanship and are told to live with the master but not touch a sword. Suddenly, after 12 years, they pick up a sword for the first time and find that they have mastered the art. Later on, a new generation of disciples would need more articulated teachings from Baba, and they would be provided. But even in my day, osmosis had its limits, and we yearned for some cognitive input. Now you have to remember there was nothing going on, as Swamiji emphasizes. No television, no magazines, no newspapers. Finally, Baba recognized our need and gave in. In late July 1971, he announced that beginning on Thursday, he would meet with us and answer our questions. How exciting. We cleaned up from our afternoon seva and gathered in the courtyard, the picture you saw. It was August 5th, the heart of the monsoon season. Because of the likelihood of rain, the session was to be held in Baba's apartment, and we filed in with reverent anticipation. Most of us had never been in this sacred place before. Baba lived in an inner room, and around two sides of it was an L-shaped veranda, long and narrow like a hallway, but wider. It was oddly designed apartment, yet it gave us a yogic message. We were not quite in the sanctum sanctorum, but we were close. It seemed right that the Siddha Guru should live in the core of the ashram in a cave-like room with no windows. Baba took his seat on a lounge chair at the junction of the L. There couldn't have been more than 50 of us living in the ashram at that time, and we were able to jam ourselves into the space. In the ashram, men and women always sat in separate sections at all programs, whether for cultural or yogic reasons. In Baba's apartment, the men sat in one wing of the L and the women in the other. Baba wore a lapel microphone for the tape recorder. Cassette tape recorders were brand new in those days, and Baba got a kick out of them. He loved to record our chanting sessions and then play them back while everyone sat around listening. Our questions were written on bits of paper. as Baba answered Professor Jane, would translate to us phrase by phrase. These sessions were held once a week in the beginning and three times a week later on. We asked Baba every conceivable question about sadhana, spiritual practice. This was not a group of dabblers, but 24 hours a day, 7 days a week yogis. And every aspect of the path interested us and confused us. We asked him about food, about sleep, about the mind, about mantra, about meditation, about psychic powers, about the guru, and about God. Many of the questions centered on the guru-disciple relationship and on issues of surrender. After a year or two of these sessions, Uma told me she was going to collect Baba's answers and create a series of books. Ultimately, these became the five volumes of Satsang with Baba. Just as you don't notice the importance of water in every drink, Baba's genius could easily be overlooked. When Uma told me her plan, I thought, but did not say, those big books won't be very interesting, because everything that Baba says is merely simple, straightforward truth. As if simple, straightforward truth were something to be despised rather than celebrated on earth, as in heaven. Well, thank you, Uma. You were right, and I was wrong. I have been sharing the teachings in these brilliant books in my own satsang at least once a month for over 25 years. So that's what we get tonight.
Welcome everyone to Satsang. Very nice to see you. You can feel the festivity of the season coming in. When do we have Christmas Satsang? In 2 weeks?
23rd.
That's 2 weeks, right? Yes, yes, okay. Okay. I like to begin every program by, as my guru Swami Muktananda did, by saying in Hindi, Sabko bade sammane ke saath prem se hrudik swagat. With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And he would always say, to welcome another person is the heart of spirituality. So in that spirit, I welcome you. He also said, God has given us everything. We must also do something in return. People wonder how to love God. He's residing in every being. So to see him in every individual is the real worship of God, real meditation, real dharma, real duty. So that's Baba's welcome. So in that spirit, I welcome you all to Satsang. As Devi Ma said, that tonight I'm doing the program called Ganesh Puri Days, like my book. My book's going to be called Ganesh Puri Days. But this program of Ganesh Puri Days is readings from those books which I didn't believe had any worth that Uma put together. These are the question answers from my day with Baba. So first let's show some pictures of Baba. Now, I've evolved two different kinds of Baba program. My favorite program is Baba. That's a big shock to you, isn't it? I mean, I love the Yoga Vashishta, and I love to do Ramana Maharshi, and Nisargadatta, and Aurobindo, and Zen. What else do I do? What?
Bhagwan.
Luckily, he's beyond caring, right? Yeah, that's Bhagwan there. Who else?
I don't know.
I don't know, whatever. I love them all, but of course, my favorite one's Baba. So first there was Ganesh Puri Days, based on my time with Baba, which was in the early 70s. I spent 3 years in his ashram. It was a very intense time of growth for me,
And along with growth, there's no growth without, just like you can't cook without heat, so you can't grow without fire. So there's a lot of growing pains along with the growth. But I remember those days fondly. Then there's another Baba, and that was the Baba that was on tour in the West, because he made 3 world tours. And when he spoke in the West, it had a very different flavor. And most of the time, I wasn't with him because he'd sent me out to run ashram. But occasionally, I would dart in and, you know, see him, spend a little time. And so that was that. So that's that, Baba. That's another kind of program, which I call Baba on Tour.
What?
Baba on Tour, I call. But lately, I found another program, which if you come on the 29th, I will unveil. And it's called, did I give it a name yet?
Not yet.
It's not named, but the one who names it will get a prize.
Maybe Ganesh Puri Tour.
Ganesh Puri, well, it's later, it's actually Baba in Ganesh Puri later in the period I wasn't there anymore, when it had grown much bigger. As you heard, there were about 50 people jammed in the room. By the time Baba died, there were, 1,000, 2,000, I don't know, ridiculous number there. You could hardly get in his living room.
What? Too many.
Many too many people. But why am I telling you all this? And by way of saying that, this is the Baba from my Ganesh Puri days. This is what he looked like in those years, the early 70s. And behind him is a little door and into his apartment. And he would come out and he'd sit there and meet people at various times during the day. This is in the central courtyard at the ashram in Ganesh Puri. So what else do you have? This is Baba from those days. He looks like there's been the end of a chant or something.
Looks like wearing velvet.
What?
Looks like wearing velvet.
Does. Looks quite intoxicated. And fabulous. And what else? And this also. You can tell Baba as opposed to the tour Baba because he had a scruffy, ill-kempt look, which I loved. Also called the wild man look. When he got on tour, he was neatly coiffed. And he used to say, I'm the gentleman Swami now. So this is Baba. And before I begin, I want to mention something that an old friend of Devi Ma and mine and Sri Bud over there passed away this week. Somebody, you know him too, Vanita. He was an Ann Arbor ashramite for a while. He was in Ganesh Puri with me. He passed away this week. He was a unique figure.
You brought me to meet him.
That's exactly right. Oh my God.
What?
When he was in Ann Arbor, I was wanting to do an experiment with what a prototype of this Shiva process. I had this idea in my head. It hadn't really formed, and I wanted to bring in a therapist who could lead an ashram group. And we would combine yoga and psychology in some way. And so this fellow, Gilly was his name, said, I know a really great couple. They come in, they can... And it was Devi Ma. So very grateful to him on that score also. And here's a picture of... This is Ashram Life. This is going to be in my book, this... We're clowning around in the dorm. I don't know if you know which one I am. But I'm sitting in lotus posture in the middle. And that's my little bed roll there on the stone floor. And those are a couple of friends. And Sri Gilly is doing the Hatha Yoga on the right there.
Who's beside you lying on the floor?
That's Mark Morden from the garden.
Oh, is it?
And that's Ram and Larry on the left. So that was our dorm.
Gilly's biting. He used to love to do that, bite his toe.
He was a real character, Gilly. I mean, indescribable. He's unique. He's in the category of Premji. There's only one Premji that that you can meet in this lifetime, and there was also only one Gilly Gilly. Isn't that true? Is that a fair assessment? And I'll just tell you one story. I could tell you how he got the name Gilly Gilly, which I won't. But anyway, he got the name Gilly Gilly, and he hated the name Gilly Gilly. And so he got really upset. So he went up to Baba and said, I want a name. His name was Dan. So Baba said, okay, Gopa, which is the male of a gopi. He's a cowboy, you know, one of the young friends of Krishna. So he came into the dorm and he said, I'm not Gilly Gilly anymore. I'm Gopa. And he was really intense about it. You know, call me Gopa, don't call me Gilly Gilly. And I was out in the courtyard, and, you know, Baba gave me the name Gopa. And I was out in the courtyard, and we were sitting around Baba, and then Gilly walked by. And Baba called out to him in the sweetest way, Gilly Gilly. And that was it. He was Gilly Gilly forever. So, anyway, rest in peace, Gilly Gilly. He's with Baba now. I could tell you a bunch of stories about him. And Bud probably has 20 more.
Yeah, I was his roommate in the
NR. What? He was your roommate.
He was my roommate.
And Bud was in the Ann Arbor Ashram, yeah, many years ago. I'll tell you one more. He gave the best beginning of an experience talk ever in the history he was very weird. He'd slouch around. And he'd say things like, the world's coming to an end. Right? Yeah. World's coming to an end. It's getting worse and worse. It's coming to an end.
Antichrist.
And so he was scheduled to give a talk about his yogic experiences in front of 1,000 people. So he comes up and they introduce him and he slouches up to the microphone like this. And he goes, it all began with my mother. the whole place broke. Broke. I'll never forget it. And then when he was in Ann Arbor, he got a job putting...
Oh, no.
No, I won't tell you.
No, don't tell that.
Okay. Okay. All right, so as Devi Ma set the scene, these were question-answer sessions with Baba several times a week, eventually. And we would go into his room at the beginning and ask him about all kinds of questions. So I'll see if I can tell you some of the circumstances. We're at December 17th, 1971. I'd been there about 9 months or something like that. So Barry asked the question. Barry was an American guy. I don't want to tell you too much about Barry. Barry Gordon, his name was. He says, if one continues to perform actions with faith and devotion, even though one is aware that true faith and devotion are not present, just the desire for them, will one develop these traits? See what he's asking? It's interesting because there's a clash of values here, because Westerners tend to think that if you do certain practices without the belief, that's inauthentic. And to be authentic, you should express your true feelings. But Baba's way was very different. And so Baba said, yes, most certainly. One who doesn't have much love and faith, but is longing for them, and whose actions cultivate love and faith, will certainly obtain love and faith one day. I quite appreciate it's very difficult to have faith and love for God or for the Guru. It's not enough just to say, I have faith. Whether you have faith or not will be proved when your faith is put to a test. But if one keeps on performing actions and surrendering his actions to God, or keeps rendering service to the ashram, his heart will be purified and love and faith will certainly develop in it. So Baba's saying that that when you have a certain understanding, you should live that, even if your emotions don't catch up, even if you don't feel like doing it. And that was the ethos of the ashram when you lived there, that you got yourself through the program. Whatever happened, whatever mood you're going through, whatever you're going through, you just did the routine. And you clung to that, and sometimes you're going through a freak out, and sometimes you're going through intense anxiety, and sometimes you're going through rage, sometimes you're going through despair. You still go through the routine. That was the discipline. And then it would shift, and then you'd come back in touch with bliss. You like that? Another one. This is a question by Lowell. Where's Lowell from, Devi Ma?
Canada?
Yes. In fact, Lowell came, visited this very ashram about 10 or 12 years ago, something like that. Lowell's from Canada. He was eventually the head of the Upper Garden. He says, what are the signs of true discrimination and how is this developed? This is a very interesting question. Baba says, if your heart becomes pure, true discrimination will arise itself. True discrimination is that which arises from within. It's not something that you can import from outside or what you can receive from somebody else. When through service to the guru, through devotion, through chanting, and through meditation, your heart becomes purified, knowledge arises from within, and that is true discrimination. So if I were to ask how to define what's discrimination about, discrimination is about making good choices. And Shiva process, inquiry we do, is a training ground for that. It's to move, we would call it following the upward shift. It means moving towards the light. In every moment you have a choice to move towards the light or move towards the dark, metaphorically. To move towards Shakti or to move towards emptiness, dryness. To move towards the right, move in the right direction, move in the wrong direction. Move towards joy, move towards misery. So this is a choice we have. Discrimination is to see that choice, understand that choice, and make the right choice. This is discrimination, and it's not developed easily. Sometimes we know I should do that, but I don't want to. That's not discrimination. But at least you know what you should do. You're just not doing it. A lot of times people don't know they should do that. They don't know. So they're completely confused. But once you know what you should do, moment to moment, you know what choice, and then you have the capability also of making that choice, then you're well on the path. And then you're well on the path towards joy, towards love, towards peace, to do actions that expand love. Not actions that expand hatred, that move, do actions that expand connectedness, not actions that create separateness, to do actions that move towards wisdom rather than towards ignorance. That's the, that's discrimination. Baba says, there isn't much point in reading what has been written by others and then explaining it to others. That's not true discrimination. You like that? As a love for the Lord or for the Guru becomes deeper and deeper, then inspiration arises from within, and that is in discrimination. The inner understanding by means of which you can discriminate between the false and the true is what we call discrimination. You know, I always read that in the scriptures, that discrimination is to separate the false from the true. I never could understand it until I understood it viscerally. It means to move towards what's good for you and to move away from what's bad for you. That's easy, isn't it? I don't think so. It's, as the song goes, easier said than done. But that's what the whole ballgame is about, to be able to separate that to see it and then to make that move. Moment to moment, those choices come up. And moment to moment, we always have the capacity to make good choices. We may not have the strength or the understanding to do it, but it's always in principle there. And as we meditate and as we grow in terms of our inner work, in terms of our spiritual work, we get the power to see, to understand the right direction and then to move in the right direction. So he goes on, he says, the inner understanding by means of which you can discriminate between the false and the true is discrimination. The moment you surrender self to the Lord or the Guru, discrimination arises. And that is also called inner inspiration. So there's a surrender involved, an inner surrender, letting go and moving in the right direction. I like that. Here's one you'll enjoy. André, he was a French guy. The French were always very colorful in the ashram. This is one of the most colorful answers. I remember it vividly. It's one of those questions and answers you think, thank God I didn't ask that. André said, I will not do a French. I have been obliged to go to Bombay four times. Bus and train were very crowded. Bodies were touching. Then my skin began to burn. It was painful. Then the muscles and bones were also paining. Sometimes I also feel as if I were being electrocuted. And I get nauseous. Can I do anything about it? Baba, this shows weakness of mind. I go, woo! As the mind becomes stronger, this trouble will vanish. It's just a passing phase. It will vanish by itself. End of his answer. Sometimes Baba would answer like 6 pages worth. That was it. Weakness of mind. Okay. All right, here's one. I want to get time for the... All right. This is one by December 24th, 1971, by Shankar. I feel very vulnerable reading this question. So I asked Baba.
I found a question by you that you've never read.
There are probably several.
No, I don't think there are that many.
Which one?
You'd be embarrassed.
I'm really glad you brought that up now. Oh, that one. No, I have no idea what she's talking about. You won't believe me, but there were some questions which were misassigned. Yes. Particularly that one. Okay, Shankar asked, sometimes I think that certain improvements could be made in the ashram. This creates a problem. Is my ego trying to assert itself by not accepting the way things are done here? Or on the other hand, am I taking an interest because the ashram is becoming more and more my home? How should I deal with this problem? Oh. Baba says, you should first find out whether any improvements are really needed. If they're needed, do try to bring them about. It's generally seen that people who try to improve things only succeed in spoiling them. Take the case of the modern reformers. We find that instead of reforming the world, they only bring disaster to themselves. It's very good that you feel so attached to the ashram. And in fact, you should feel that the ashram is your body. Just as you take care of your body, you should take care of the ashram. It's only then that your devotion will be complete. If improvements are needed, they should certainly be made. But you should bear in mind that an ashram should not be turned into a place of comfort and luxury. In an ashram, it's very essential to live a life of discipline, regularity, and hard work, because hard work is essential for the body and contemplation of the self. But whatever improvements are absolutely necessary, they should be made. I like the latter part of your statement very much. It's a sign of a higher stage in devotion to begin to consider the ashram to be just like your body. He knows I'm listening, like, is he going to kill me? You know? So anyway, you're not like that? All right, you ready for two more? Okay. This is an interesting question. Jorgen, you didn't know Jorgen. Jorgen was from, where would a guy named Jorgen be? Scandinavia. No, not him. Norway or something. No, that's a different Jorgen. It was a League of Nations there. There was, we had every Western nation, but many Indians, obviously. It was about half Westerners when I was there and half Indians. Later, the Westerners just outnumbered everyone. They came in from all over the world. But there were a lot of Europeans, and I met my first Australians there, lots of Australians, and Americans, and all kinds of things. Anyway, Jorgen from Norway or Sweden or something. What? Denmark or something. He says, for a seeker who follows the path of Siddha Yoga, is his spiritual progress due to the grace of the Guru? It is said that all that has a beginning has also an end. Therefore, I ask, what happens to the seeker if he for some reason should lose the grace he once received from his Guru? Is there a sudden downfall or what? Worried about it, huh? Baba says, you can achieve perfection in Siddha Yoga only through the grace of a Siddha, a realized master. The yoga which you receive through the grace of the Guru will also be consummated by his grace, and there's no doubt about it. Generally, it's seen that once you receive the grace of the Guru, you don't lose it easily. The Guru is not like an ordinary businessman who would refuse to serve you a cup of tea if you didn't pay the price. Even if a disciple were to behave foolishly and turn away from the Guru, a Siddha Guru would not become angry with him for quite some time. For some time. If a disciple has received the Guru's grace, why should he be so stupid as to lose it? Why should he begin to live such an impure life that he would lose the grace in course of time? Why should he be so ungrateful? It's a different matter if a teacher is revengeful. A true guru will never be vindictive. But if you happen to lose the grace of a teacher, then you should look for another who's equally as great and receive his grace. In the Upanishads, the story is told of a very significant event. Yajnavalkya was a very great sage, and on a certain matter, he came to have a serious difference with his guru, as a result of which his guru discarded him. Yajnavalkya at once went to the realm of the sun, and he learned higher knowledge from the sun. If you have lost the grace of a guru, you can win the grace of another without any loss of time, and you shouldn't worry about it. You like that? So move on. You like that question answer? Yeah. Okay, I'll do the last one. It's a little longer, but it's about meditation. And then we can meditate. It's a beautiful answer. It's from Olivier. Olivier is another Frenchman. Olivier. He says, I've got problems with my meditation. Some people say you should use your mantra. Other people say you should empty your mind of all thoughts. Please tell me the right way to meditate. That's a good question, isn't it? Have you ever been hung up on that particular thing? Yes or no? Anybody? Yeah, anyway. What will Baba say? If you know Baba, he'll say all things at once. Baba says, people say what, and this was an important answer for me. I'll explain why in the middle, because it just showed me something interesting. I think a cultural thing, maybe. People say whatever comes to their minds without weighing their words, he says. If the advice comes from one who actually meditates, who has attained a certain state through meditation, that advice has some value. But if it comes from someone who's only read books or is only talking from hearsay, that advice has no value. There are also books written by professionals, people who write for name, money, and status. Can a seeker be redeemed by their writings? The other day, a professor came here who wanted to write a thesis for his PhD on the subject of Kundalini Yoga. Kundalini Yoga. Did I say Kundalini Yoga? Yes. But he didn't have time to meditate even for an hour. To write this thesis, he's going from one saint to another, getting ideas from them. Whatever he may write in his thesis, how can an aspirant be helped by such writing? The writer himself is sinking, so how can his readers swim to the other shore? 2 years ago, a professor from France came here. He wanted to write his PhD on Nirvikalpa Samadhi. I said, first tell me what you know about Savikalpa Samadhi. So Nirvikalpa Samadhi means samadhi, deep trance with no thought forms, no vikalpas, no thoughts. Well, Savikalpa means a trance where thoughts are present. So one is samadhi with form and the other is formless samadhi. So two levels of deep meditation. So Baba says, he said, I don't know what Savikalpa Samadhi is. Please tell me. Baba says, not to know Savikalpa and to write on Nirvikalpa for a PhD, what a mockery. The examiners also know nothing about Savikalpa or Nirvikalpa Samadhi. The PhD examiners. They have no personal experiences. They're only impressed by the fine phrases which the student has used, so they award the PhD. If you happen to read a book written by such a person, how can it help you? And with that statement, how can it help you? My mind was blown. My mind was blown because I was seeing it from a different perspective, because I'd been from an academic background. And I saw that the answers didn't lie in academia. But I saw Baba's point of view on it, that a book on a subject like yoga should help you. It should uplift you. It should make you grow and see the light and bring you closer to your own truth. But actually, an academic book is not written for that purpose at all. It's written to impress other people, and to get a job, and to make a reputation. And in fact, you don't want to be involved in it. You want to be distant from it and just write about it from out there. This one says this, and that book says that, and like that. So it was like, blew my mind. I saw Baba's very sort of sweetly naive point of view. If you're going to write a book on samadhi, it should be to help people get there. I thought, boy, the emperor's new clothes. You get what I'm saying? So simple and obvious. Baba says, you should ask those who say to empty the mind of all thoughts, can you do that? Can you sweep the mind with a broom? I have full control over this room. I can turn all of you out at any time and make the room completely empty. But can you do the same with your mind? Can you order all thoughts to leave your mind and make it empty? So what's the point of saying, empty your mind? How are you going to empty it? If you've ever tried to empty your mind, it takes many years of practice to actually be able to do this practice. It's true that the definition of meditation given in the scriptures is absolutely correct. It says the state of meditation is a state in which the mind is completely free of thoughts. But to achieve that state of complete thoughtlessness, thought freeness, I guess I'd say, you have to subject the mind to one particular thought for a very long time. Only then will the mind become free of all thoughts. So Baba is saying, first, repeat the mantra. Bring it to one point. And meditate on one thought or one idea And then it can pass into the thought-free state. Exactly. It's extremely difficult to keep the mind empty for any length of time. However, you can keep it engaged with only one thought for a considerable length of time through mantra, japa, repetition of mantra. All the great saints of our country, such as Tulsidas, Mirabai, and Tukaram, whose words are considered to be as true as mantras, meditated on some object. So he's saying, have an object to meditate on, whether it be a mantra or something else. Only that way could they achieve the objectless state. Take the case of Tukaram Maharaj. Through meditating on form, he attained the formless. But on the contrary, he who tries to meditate on the formless becomes obsessed with the world. Therefore, it's quite proper to use the mantra. So what's Baba saying to him? Don't try to empty your mind. Bring it to one point through using the mantras. That's what he's telling him so far. If you really wish to learn yoga, you should use Patanjali as the authority. Of course, Patanjali is the classical text, about 1,500 years old. The Yoga Sutras, which is a list, a series of aphorisms on meditation. Very profound work. He says, there's no higher authority on the subject of meditation than Patanjali, whatever claims any teacher should make for himself. Patanjali was not a stage lecturer. He had practiced yoga himself. Then he came to certain conclusions and wrote them down. Patanjali's authority is as supreme in yoga as that of Narada in bhakti, in devotion, or Vyasa in the field of knowledge, referring to great scriptures, Narada's bhakti sutras and so on. Nobody coming after these three can change or modify the conclusions arrived by them. It is Patanjali who says that meditation implies the state in which the mind becomes completely free of thoughts. Yoga's chitta vritti nirodha. This is his first aphorism. Yoga is to still the thought waves of the mind. But it's extremely difficult to achieve such a state. Therefore, engage your mind with one particular object or thought. For that, you should repeat the mantra. Keep on repeating the mantra continuously, keeping yourself fully aware of its meaning. That will make the mind one-pointed. The state of total thought-freeness is a very high state. As long as the mind does not become free of all objects, you'll have to rely on the mantra. Anyone who's thoroughly proficient in this field will tell you what I'm telling you. Patanjali says that you should repeat the mantra for a prolonged period of time, continually in an unbroken stream with full earnestness. He says that. He says that you have to do it for a long period with devotion, with good feeling, and then it'll bear fruit. It is only then you can achieve the stage of thought of being thought free. It is only when you get the mind to stick to one object that it'll be able to remain free from all objects. Continue to repeat your mantra. And if in the course of the using the mantra, the mind becomes still for a while, that is a very good state. So work with form to get to the formless, he's saying. Work with the mantra. The mantra is always a great friend. Like that? Very interesting. But it blew my mind that that Baba said, why bother to write a book unless it's to help people? That's a wonderful view of humanity, isn't it? So let's meditate. Let's meditate for 10 minutes. And how will we meditate? Well, keep your mind free of all thoughts. You were listening, good. Now just, you can repeat the mantra, and we can play the mantra for a minute or so. And just repeat the mantra. The mantra refers to the inner self. Om Namah Shivaya means I bow to the self, I call on the self, I honor the deepest, most profound, most real part of me. So repeat that, and then gradually other thoughts will fall away. If they come in, just let them be there. Just keep your mind on the mantra. and eventually you'll be able to go deep in meditation. So let's meditate now for 10 minutes. And once again, with great love and respect, I welcome you all with all my heart. Satgurunath Maharaj Ki Jai. Let's meditate.